are tuned into Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Welcome to another edition of Stark Raven. Stark Raven takes a closer look at prisons and the politics of criminalization. And we're here the first 3 Mondays of each month from 7 until 8 p.m. My name is Emily Aspinwall, and I'll be your host for this evening. And tonight, we're going to look at women's imprisonment. It is on the rise, and then we're going to take a look at the global picture. In our news section, Vic Taves proposed 3 strikes and you're out. A critical look at the death penalty in Florida. A virtual fence is promised on the BC border. And the war on terror is responsible for tens of thousands of deaths worldwide. Later on in the show, we're going to be looking at a new law passed in the United States. It redefines torture and prevents detainees from challenging their detention. We'll have more of that on the feature section. We're also going to hear from Mumia Abu-Jamal and have community announcements for you at the end of the show close to 8 o'clock. So stay tuned to Stark Raven for the next hour here on Co-op Radio. It is CFRO 102.7 FM. God, oh Canada. Women make up one of the fastest growing prisoner populations in the world. There are now over 500,000 women and girls locked up in prisons, jails, and detention centers around the globe. Here to give us a closer look at women's imprisonment globally is Rob Allen. Rob is the director of the International Center for Prison Studies at the University of London in England. The center recently published the first World Female Imprisonment List. Rob joins us on the phone from the center's office in London. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
That's a pleasure.
What did you discover when you looked at women's incarceration globally?
Well, perhaps the most interesting thing that we discovered was the variation in the extent to which women comprise numbers in prison. What I mean is, in some countries, in most countries, women represent about 3 or 4% of the total prison population, usually something between 2 and 9%. But in some countries of the world, they represent a very much larger figure than that. In one case, over 20%, that's in Hong Kong, in China, over 20% of the prison population comprises women. Now, our work so far has really been looking at the figures and assembling the population figures from as many countries as we could get information about. Of course, the next step is to try to ask some questions about why there is the variation in the numbers of women, what kinds of factors account for the fact that in Thailand, for example, 17% of the prison population are made up of women, whereas in countries like Canada, it's only 5%.
And which countries had the greatest numbers of women in prison?
Well, it tends to be countries in Asia and in the Americas. The highest populations of women, the proportions are in Hong Kong, China, in Myanmar, in Thailand, in Vietnam, some of the Middle East countries, but not all of them have high populations. Also, some of the countries in South America have highish proportions. So it's not an easy pattern. It's not a straightforward pattern. But we have some ideas about some of the factors that may be important in determining the numbers of women.
So I know you compiled women as a percentage of the overall population, but you also compiled statistics on the actual numbers of women, and I know the United States makes up almost, I believe, half or close to half of that 500,000 women. But I did also notice that you didn't compile per capita statistics that perhaps might be more revealing as to the rate of imprisonment of women, and I was just wondering why that was.
Well, we didn't do that on this occasion. We do produce an overall world prison list, and we have an online World Prison Brief that has got detailed information about prison numbers in different countries. On this occasion, we didn't have the capacity to find detailed figures about the number of women in each of the countries. So we decided not to do that on this occasion. You're right, of course, the big countries have the big numbers, but it is just an interesting reminder that that it really is the United States, China, and the Russian Federation, which are the big imprisoners, both of men and women, and it's a third of all the women, in fact, in prison are in the United States, and the United States, by some margin, has the largest per capita prison population in the world.
So the Center for Prison Studies has been publishing the general world prison population list for several years now, but this is the first time that you've published specific statistics about women in prison. Why did you decide to start highlighting the situation for women at this time?
Well, I think it's it was a number of reasons, really. Our center is basically a research center, so we undertake studies on different aspects of the use of prison and the practice of imprisonment. But we also do practical work in a number of countries around the world, trying to improve prison conditions and trying to ensure that prison systems adhere to international norms and standards. And I think in doing some of that practical work, whenever one visits a prison with women in, one is always filled, or speaking personally, I'm always filled with a sense of a great sadness about the costs, the human costs of imprisonment. It seems with women to be rather sharper than it is with men, perhaps rightly or wrongly. But I suppose the real reason for that is that in many cases around the world, women are carers of children. And of course, in other than in a small number of cases, women are unable to fulfill that role while they are incarcerated. So the costs of imprisonment, the social human costs, are, I think, substantially greater in the case of imprisoning women, particularly those who are mothers or carers of dependent children, which makes the whole practice of imprisonment perhaps a bigger social issue. Although the numbers are a lot smaller, perhaps the consequences are serious ones. And also, the reality in many countries is that women who end up in prison have ended up there not for the same kinds of crimes or offenses that men have. I mean, certainly in my own country, the United Kingdom, there are many more women in prison for offenses such as theft, fraud, drug offenses, not serious violent crimes, but rather offenses that are much more a part of a kind of a life that has kind of gone wrong in various ways, often caught up with drug addiction, perhaps prostitution, and in a very real sense a social problem rather than a criminal one. So I think we wanted to sort of draw together some data to try and get a discussion going about whether really prison is the best response that a society can make to these very troubled women often, or whether we ought to be looking at alternatives, whether that's community-based treatment, whether it's drug treatment, whether it's better mental health care, or a combination of all these things.
So why do you think that the incarceration of women is on the rise?
Well, I think it's a complicated question. One of the interesting things that I suspect is the case, and again, we haven't tested all of these theories yet, but in some of the countries which have high proportions of women in prison, quite a large percentage will be foreign prisoners. Certainly, again, in my own country, the United Kingdom, there are some prisons where over half of the prisons, women's prisons, where over half of the women in prison are foreign nationals, often from the Caribbean, Jamaica, or African countries, often having been convicted of trying to smuggle drugs into the country and receiving long sentences for doing so. And to the extent that we live in a much more globalized society, international travel is easier, the drugs problem shows no sign of abating, the opportunities, if you like, for people, but perhaps women in particular, to be involved in these kinds of offenses might be greater than it was perhaps 15, 20 years ago. There is, in many parts of the world, increasing kind of migration, increasing movement of people between countries, and that places some women at risk of becoming involved in criminal activity, often at the behest of men who effectively use women to get involved in criminal activity of one sort or another. But the explanations are really are probably quite complicated and deep-seated, and we haven't really tested them out. So these are very much kind of arguments and hypotheses at the moment.
You mentioned the migration in our globalized world of people. I'm wondering if you have any comment on the role of immigration detention in these statistics.
Well, certainly in many of the prisons that I have visited, ordinary criminal prisons in developing countries and transitional countries, there are both men and women who are held in those prisons who are actually in large part immigration cases, by which I mean their offending, their criminality may have been relatively minor, but because they do not have the correct papers, they may not have a passport, they may not have the right to be in a country, then they are placed in prison, and often for much longer than the seriousness of the crime deserves. And sadly, in many countries, they are effectively abandoned by their host country. The embassy or the consulate of that country doesn't really want to know anything about them, makes very little effort to return them to their countries. In some places, I've visited prisoners who were quite keen to return to their country of origin, but simply had no money to be able to afford the transportation back. So I think there is a scope for some international action about at least some of those prisoners, who both men and women, who end up being detained away from home. Some of them won't want to return to their countries of origin, but some of them do, and where they do, I don't think we do as much as we could to enable that to happen.
And I was just wondering about how you compile the statistics. I think a lot of the statistics come from government prison administrations, and I was just wondering if you had any comment on how you deal with countries that either don't report all their prisoner populations, or if you have any comment on the process of compiling these statistics.
Well, you're right. Most of the sources of information are the national prison administrations or the justice ministries of the countries concerned. There are other reasonably solid sources of information, whether they are other countries, the United Nations, surveys that have been done, non-governmental organizations of one sort or another. But there are some gaps in our data. We haven't got information about all the countries of the world. There are some big gaps in some big countries like China, which doesn't give information out about the number of pre-trial detention prisoners or those that are held in administrative detention. It only releases information about those who are held in sentenced prisoners who are held in facilities run by the Ministry of Justice. So there's a big gap there. Obviously, we are always trying to update and compile the statistics as accurately as we can from what sources we can. But inevitably, particularly in poorer countries, there will not be the systems for keeping track of numbers in the perhaps the way that more developed countries have got. So countries like Canada or European countries on the whole have reasonably sophisticated systems for being able to know on a daily or weekly basis how many people are locked up by the state, but this won't necessarily be the case in other countries, and we need to be aware of that.
You do a lot of research at the center there and must have, when you're going in to compile new statistics or do new research, have ideas around what the outcome of that research is going to be. And I'm just wondering what you found most surprising about this research around the rates of women's incarceration globally.
Well, as I say, I think it raises as many questions as it resolves. I think we're certainly quite keen to pursue some of the questions that I've mentioned. The issue about the involvement of women in drug trafficking, I think, is worthy of much greater exploration, and whether there is a need to detain women for many years sometimes in the country where they have been arrested. The decision certainly in the UK is based entirely on the amount of drugs that are involved. There is no consideration given to the situation of the woman, whether she has children, the consequences for her. And at the end of that sentence, in most cases, the woman will be deported, having spent perhaps 10, 12 years in a prison in the developed world. She will be returned to the developing world. That doesn't seem a particularly sensible solution to that particular problem. So I think we will want to pursue that. The linked question of foreign prisoners, foreign national prisoners, and how best to deal with them. I suspect that many of the countries which have high numbers of women in prison as a high proportion, you will find that a lot of those women will be foreign nationals. They may be workers from overseas who have come in. Maybe they their papers, the legitimacy of their stay has been called into question. They've got involved in relatively minor criminality, but nonetheless face a system which effectively discriminates against them on the grounds that they are foreign nationals. So I think the research has raised a lot of questions rather than a lot of answers, but I hope that that we will be able to do something on it. But really, I hope that it acts as a stimulus for the individual countries and the prison administrations and the justice systems in those countries to have a look at the women's prison numbers in their own country, to see whether there are not alternative sentences for some of the more minor cases that could be developed, to look at ways of minimizing the consequences for families and for children, and so on. So I hope it's a stimulus to further research, but also to further action to try and reduce the damage that prison causes.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Rob.
No, it's been a pleasure.
We have been speaking with Rob Allen. Rob is the director of the International Center for Prison Studies in London, England. For more information on the World Female Imprisonment List and the International Center for Prison Studies, you can check their website. It's www.prisonstudies.org.
Thank you.
That was some Bessie Smith off of her album Downhearted Blues, and that was the track Jailhouse Blues. You're listening to Co-op Radio. It is CFRO 102.7 FM, and you can conveniently also find us on the internet, live streaming www.coopradio.org. This is Stark Raven. We take a closer look at prisons and the politics of criminalization, and we'll be back in a couple moments with the news.
Join me, Kevin Pina, documentary filmmaker and journalist, as I screen the final cut of my new film, Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits. The film will be shown Friday, October 13th at 7 p.m. at Simon Fraser University Harbor Center, 515 West Hastings Street, Vancouver. Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits documents the horror of a Canada, U.S., and France-led coup d'etat and military occupation by United Nations forces. History repeating.
Right, it's time for the news here on Stark Raven.
The border between U.S. and Canada will be subject to American-initiated high-tech surveillance. The setup will include motion detectors, infrared cameras, and watchtowers. Targeted areas will be in B.C. and Ontario. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff called it a virtual 21st century fence. The project is part of what is termed the Secure Border Initiative. Boeing Corporation was awarded a U.S. government contract worth $70 million U.S. to set up the surveillance. It is estimated that the U.S. will spend more than $2.5 billion U.S. on the Secure Border Initiative.
The Conservative government is working on a three strikes, you're out bill. After three convictions for violent crimes, people would have to prove to a judge why they're not dangerous. This is a reversal of the traditional innocent until proven guilty principle. Currently, someone convicted of a violent offense can be declared a dangerous offender after a court hearing initiated by Crown prosecutors. The dangerous offender designation is akin to a life sentence, although people can begin applying for parole after 7 years. Unlike California's famous three strikes you're out law, the proposed federal bill will not trigger an automatic life sentence for repeat offenders. Currently, there are about 25 dangerous offender designations made each year in Canada. Plans are to introduce the bill to the legislature this fall.
The war on terror has directly killed more than 60,000 people since September 2001. Some say the numbers could be as high as 180,000. The large majority of these deaths are civilians killed in the war in Iraq. The war on terror has also created 4.5 million refugees worldwide. The U.S. Congress has approved almost $440 billion U.S. for costs related to the war on terror. That is more than the total sum needed to pay off the debts of every poor nation on earth. The numbers are compiled by the British newspaper The Independent.
Florida's death penalty system is plagued with problems of fairness, accuracy, and racism. Florida's handling of the death penalty was investigated by the American Bar Association, and the findings were released in a recent report. The report found that those convicted of killing a white victim are far more likely to get a death sentence. There is also a lack of oversight and funding for attorneys who handle death row appeals. Florida is the only state that allows a jury to recommend death by mere majority. The report expressed grave concerns about the number of innocent people who are on death row in Florida. More than 20 prisoners have been found innocent and released from death row since 1973. This is the highest number of any of the states in the United States. Combined, those exonerated spent more than 150 years in prison before being released. And that's the end of the news here on Stark Raven.
I know there's got to be a way. I just need a little rest, Lord. Lord, grant me one more day. When I was a young man, oh, I believe the world was mine. Now I'm walking down the back streets. Running out of time, I got to call upon my captain. Please stand by my side. I may not have succeeded. God knows that I tried when I was a young man. I believe the world was mine. Oh. Now I struggle down these back streets and oh Lord, I may be running out of time. Seven seas. I've lived a life men dream of and struggled to be free. When I was a young man, I truly did believe the world was mine. Now I'm walking down the back streets and maybe running out of time. Running out of time. Oh Lord, I may be running out of time. running out of time.
You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, and this is Stark Raven. And we're going to go now to our feature on the U.S. government's actions around military commissions. The U.S. Senate has passed a bill that gives the U.S. president unprecedented power to detain and try people as part of their war on terror. The Military Commissions Act strips the right of detainees to habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is the traditional right of detainees to be able to challenge their detention in court. It also gives the U.S. president the power to detain indefinitely anyone it deems to be an enemy combatant. This includes any U.S. or foreign national from both within the U.S. and from abroad. The bill's definition has been criticized as being so broad that even lawyers could be considered enemy combatants. The new legislation allows for the use of secret and coerced evidence produced through torture. It also gives U.S. officials immunity from prosecution for torturing detainees that were captured before the end of 2005 by the U.S. military and CIA. The bill will eliminate some rights common in military and civilian courts. For example, the commission would be allowed to consider hearsay evidence so as long as the judge determined it was reliable. Hearsay is currently barred from civilian courts. The legislation has been condemned by many politicians, human rights groups, and newspapers around the world as a violation of international law and an invitation to torture. The bill has also been criticized by the top United Nations official on torture. Manfred Novak said the bill could deprive terrorism suspects of a fair trial. He said it was especially troubling after the mistreatment of prisoners at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. Amnesty International says the legislation will lead to violations of international law and standards. Many legal experts argue the new military trial rules will draw vigorous court challenges and could be struck down for violating rights guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution. Originally, U.S. President George Bush wanted to revise the United States' obligations to the Geneva Conventions as part of this bill. During the debates over the bill, a group of Republican senators spoke out against these possible revisions and put forth some proposals in the amended bill. Max Laverne of The Wire, which is a community radio broadcast in Australia, spoke to Christopher H. Pyle. He's a professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Christopher Pyle explains how even though the act does not directly change the U.S. relationship to the Geneva Conventions, the new bill will still have an effect on how the U.S. interprets the conventions.
It does in theory, but not in practice. The administration agreed not to amend the Geneva Conventions. If we had done that, we'd have been one of the first nations to abrogate the Geneva Conventions. But what we did instead, if this bill passes, is amend the law that enforces the Geneva Conventions. So we'll be in a situation where there are rights without remedies.
The tearaway Republican senators led by McCain appeared to take the moral high ground, arguing that to repeal the Geneva Conventions would cause other countries to doubt the righteousness of America's cause, as well as endanger American troops overseas. But Christopher Pyle takes a different view.
They didn't take the moral high ground. They compromised these rights away. And the most serious thing they did was to strip the U.S. courts of the authority to review cases where people were challenging the legality of their detentions and their treatment.
In legal terms, this is known as habeas corpus, or the writ by means of which detainees can seek release from unlawful imprisonment.
This bill purports to suspend the privilege of habeas corpus. It is probably unconstitutional, but for a long time, before we litigate all that, people will be denied a chance to question their incarceration.
Kep Enderby QC, the former Attorney General to the Whitlam government, argued that any compromise was a serious regression.
The trouble is that with the so-called rebellious Republican politicians who are trying to reach a compromise, but what sort of a compromise is this going to be? The values that we've achieved in this country and the United States took centuries to achieve, and now they're all being watered down and thrown out the window. It's not progress, it's regress, it's regression of a very serious kind.
The deal grants amnesty to Bush administration officials as well as CIA and military personnel who may be guilty of war crimes retroactive to 1997. Christopher Pyle emphasized just how exceptional the situation is.
This is the first president who's gone to Congress and asked that we repeal the criminal law so that his people, and maybe himself, will not be open to prosecution. And they desperately needed this. In June, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the Geneva Conventions were applicable through the War Crimes Act. This put a shock through the administration because it meant that all their personnel who had been disregarding the Geneva Conventions were now vulnerable to prosecution. Not just the interrogators, but Bush administration officials who created tribunals that would receive evidence obtained by torture, people like the Secretary of Defense who issued authority for harsh interrogations, all of them were vulnerable now to prosecution under Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. So they were panicked, and this amnesty provision is the most important single provision as far as they're concerned. They don't want to face the possibility that a future administration will prosecute them, like General Pinochet of Chile is vulnerable to prosecution now.
There's been much concern that the agreement doesn't go far enough, but do you think that in today's political climates, the rights of terrorism suspects should take a backseat to national security?
Absolutely not. They're suspects. And a suspect should have the presumption of innocent until proven guilty. A suspect should have every right available. We're all suspects when we're arrested. Why should we make a difference between classes of suspects?
Well, some would say that we live in an era where individuals have more power to perpetrate crimes on a larger scale than ever before.
I think that that's silly. Individuals have had capacity to perpetrate huge crimes. Back in the 17th century, there was a gunpowder plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament. That would have been equivalent in its time as the attacks of September 11 are in ours. Mass destruction has always been possible by a limited number of people with the right equipment.
Christopher, all things considered, do you think it's a step forward nonetheless?
No, it suspends the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, opening people to arbitrary detention, detention without trial, without charges, with no review of how they're treated. It denies people the right to confront witnesses against them in a criminal trial. It creates kangaroo courts that can admit evidence obtained by torture. This is a travesty of American law. It shames the United States in the eyes of world opinion, and it says that the United States is still eager to torture and abuse prisoners. And that is not going to help us win the war for public opinion in Muslim nations or anywhere else.
That was Christopher H. Pyle. He's a professor of politics from Massachusetts. He spoke with Max Laverne of The Wire, which is a community radio broadcast in Australia. And they were talking about the recent bill that has passed in the United States called the Military Commissions Act. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, and this is Stark Raven, and we are here the first 3 Mondays of each month from 7 until 8 p.m., and our program takes a closer look at the politics of prisons and criminalization. We're going to hear from Mumia Abu-Jamal in a little bit and get to some community announcements, but first we're going to hear some Nina Simone off her album Little Girl Blue.
Thank you.
And that was some Nina Simone with her music from her piano days. And off their track, Little Girl Blue. And we're going to hear now from Mumia Abu-Jamal, his latest commentary. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist. He chronicles the human condition. He's been on Pennsylvania's death row for almost 25 years, and he writes from his solitary confinement cell. And his audio essays are produced by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. And his 1982 murder trial and subsequent conviction have been the subject of great debate. He continues to produce these audio broadcasts on a regular basis, and here's one of his latest.
The war that won't stop. There's been a blizzard of books released about the ill-fated Iraq War. Some have been penned by Bush insiders, others by outsiders. Such is the blizzard that the net result is often confusion, for each is written from the perspective of the writer, and to project or protect one side or the other. Well, here's another one for you. Now comes Greg Palast, the irascible author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, whose newest work is a broad, if irreverent, look at not just the Iraq disaster, but also the nation's economic debacle and other perfidies of the governing classes. Palast's new book is Armed Madhouse. Palast is perhaps best known for his BBC reports on the stolen elections in Florida and the subsequent assaults on democracy in 2004 in Ohio and beyond. What hit me, however, was his analysis of the conflicting interests of the Bush administration on the Iraq invasion and occupation. One side, he argues, wanted to use the Iraq takeover as a massive tool to crack OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, and by so doing, kick the Saudis out of the driver's seat and flood the market with cheap oil. The second option was a relatively modest invasion, the installation of a dutifully obedient puppet, but hands off oil except to control its flow. According to Palast, the objective was never to take the oil, but to control it and thereby moderate its flow. By so doing, this would keep the price at a high level based on the principle that plenty would bring prices too low. Palast writes, in the short term, Iraq's fields were trashed even before saboteurs torched them. The CIA and the Pentagon knew it no matter what, Paul Wolfowitz said to bobble-headed congressmen. In the long run, however, many years from now, Iraq, with 114 billion barrels of proven reserves, might be able to crank up above its OPEC quota. But that won't happen. The globe is littered with the economic skeletons of nations that flagrantly busted their OPEC quotas. There's a skeleton of Venezuela. In 1973, Venezuela broke the first Arab oil boycott. But in 1997, when Venezuela again ramped up production, punishment was swift. Saudi Arabia, which can live without big oil revenues for up to a year, opened its spigots and drowned the market. The price of oil dropped to $8 a barrel, and Venezuela went bankrupt. Its government fell. The current president of that nation, Hugo Chavez, is now a good member of OPEC, indeed its most fanatic adherent to the quota system. This was a war, Palast explains, not to get oil so much as it was to keep gugobs of oil in the ground. The rarer the commodity, the higher its price. Reading Palast's latest book, I thought of a quote in the book The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant. The men who can manage the men who can manage only things, and the men who can manage money manage all. This hot, deadly war is but a front in the invisible economic war. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Little hornblower, you've got a lot to say. Each knows the newest statement for that day. You stand on the corner so loud you frighten some away. You got panties for your dinner, yet you still play. Higher and higher until you seem to be floating away. So go on, get louder than before. Use your old rifle to blast them onto the floor. Take away. take away their pain. Next day new, tune for the world to hear. It's too bad you're only playing for a corner that's full of people that don't seem to care. They're struggling for a dollar to keep their feet from being bare. So go on, get louder than before. Use your rifle to blast them onto the floor. Take away their pain. Oh, won't you take away their pain? To blast them onto the floor. Take away their pain. Oh, won't you take away their pain? Well, the birds whistle, they don't care about you. They're busy flying high to the very own tune.
Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. That's what you're listening to. You could also be listening at www.coopradio.org, or you could be listening to some cable frequencies around the province. But the song you were listening to was...
It was from Ndidi Onukulu's new album, No, I Never. She's an up-and-coming blues singer from Toronto, and the track was called Hornblower.
And it's time now for some community announcements, and just wanted to remind people that the Toronto Prisoners Justice Action Committee is inviting you to submit your film or video for possible screening in the 3rd annual Prisoners Justice Film Festival. That film festival is happening February 8th to 11th next year, and they're looking for fiction, documentary, as well as shorts. So the deadline is coming up. It's October 13th. If you want more information on how and where to submit, you can check out the submission details at www.prisonjustice.ca.
Amnesty International is having their 11th annual film festival. This is going to be happening from November 2nd to 5th, 2006, being held at the Pacific Cinematheque in Vancouver. And you can check out the website. It's www.amnesty.bc.ca/filmfest. And it looks like it should be up in October.
All right, well, that's it for today's show. If you're interested in keeping in touch with Stark Raven, you can join our email list. We send out a monthly email with information about our upcoming shows, along with a digest of our recent news. So to join that email list, you can just email us at stark-raven@cooperadio.org. And we're also excited to let you know that we've started podcasting. Yay! Woo! Well, that's our excitement. All right. That's right. If you missed Stark Raven, you can now download the show at any time onto your computer and MP3 player and listen to it anytime you like. So to find out more information on how to do that and to find the links to the audio, you can go to prisonjustice.ca. And if you have any feedback for us here at Stark Raven, feel free to call us after the show. And the number is 604-684-7561. So next week, we're hopefully going to be talking more about their proposed three strikes law and hearing more about political prisoner and member of the Angola 3, Herman Wallace. And in 2 weeks, we'll be doing our member drive special, and we're going to be featuring an interview with David Tanovich. He's the author of Color of Justice, Policing Race in Canada. That's a new book about racial profiling. So it's your chance to call in and become a member. The member drive starts next Friday here on Co-op Radio. And a reminder, we are a volunteer-run station, so we rely on support from you, the listener, to keep us on the air. So consider becoming a member of Co-op Radio. We'll be mentioning that to you a few more times this month, so be sure to call in and become a member soon, 604-684-7561. And coming up next here on Co-op Radio is Think Indian, followed by Patchback, and we're going to go out and hear some more Ndidi Onukulu.
We'll send you out with the track, This May Be the Last Time, I Don't Know.
Right, and thanks, Marge, again, for coming down and reading some news and joining us here on Stark Raven.
Yay.
This may, this may be the last time. 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 This may be the last time we walk together. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time we walk together. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time. This may be the last time. This may be the last time. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time we sing together. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time we sing together. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time. This may be the last time. This may be the last time. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time we bow together. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may be the last time we bow together. This may be the last time, I don't know. This may the last time. This may be the last time. This may